Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you believe about the nature of God and human beings and the power of goodness and evil? Is there room for people who hold different views to still be right in what they believe, or does that kind of tolerance set the stage for a dangerous kind of moral relativism? Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, who describes himself as having espoused radical ideology in his youth as a West Bank settler, no longer is convinced that it does. Today, Hirschfield is a radio and TV host and president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. His latest book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism, and he's in town for an address tonight at SMU at 7:30 as part of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas and the SMU Perkins School of Theology. Welcome, Brad, to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
So, you write that we live in a world where religion is killing more people today than it has at any time since the Crusades. What is going wrong right at this moment?
Look, first of all, it's painful to admit that because I remain a believer. And one of the ways I talk about the book and actually a lot of my work is that it's a fierce critique of faith from someone who's still in love with God. And I think it's really important because people on the outside criticizing something, that's easy. Right, and I don't care if that's your faith or if that's the person you're going to bed with at night. The trick is to be able to say, look, there are issues. We have to be able to talk about them, but I promise you I'll be here in the morning for you. And the book is trying to do that. And yeah, I mean, look, there are a lot of reasons why. I think basically what happened is from the time of Jesus until the Enlightenment, we had about 1,800 years, and we killed a lot of people. And we killed them usually because God told us to, and we thought that was the way to make the world better. And then for the last 200 or so years, we said, that's not working out so well. So maybe what we'll do is we'll kill off God, and that'll make things better. We'll get rid of religion. Only we managed in those 200 years to kill as many people in the name of secularism as we did in the name of theology in the previous 1800. And then I think people were left wondering, well, what's next? And so a lot of people said, well, if this didn't work since the Enlightenment, let's go back to the old model. Let's get God back on the public stage, but let's bring God back married to a level of globalized weaponization and individual empowerment to really commit profound acts of violence that's unprecedented. And so we have a very serious problem because we have ancient beliefs married to contemporary communications and modern weapons, and that's pretty toxic. And so we're going to have to do something because simply trying to say, well, let's get rid of all faith doesn't work because that's repressing our greatest hopes and aspirations and our dreams and our fears. And that's got to be part of life. On the other hand, to bring all that stuff back like religion in the, quote, good old days, we will have the Crusades. And that can't be good either.
So do we need to look at our potential, our capacity for extremism as some kind of gift from God? Or is it purely an evil force that needs to be fought against?
It's a great question. Nothing for me is ever purely anything. And that includes the God who I usually believe in and sometimes don't. I guess what I believe about any profound, intense feeling is it can be used beautifully or it can be used terribly. Faith is like a fire. And that fire can either heat your home and cook your dinner or burn down your house. The issue isn't the faith. It's the person wielding it. And so the single most important thing to do, and this is what it means to find faith without fanaticism, whether that's faith in the person you love or faith in the political party you vote for or faith in the church you worship in, is to be able to find a commitment to it but constantly ask tough questions of it so you make sure that it doesn't get so out of control that it burns things down.
Well, you've written about struggling with this sort of duality of God. You've got the warm and fuzzy God who takes care of your sick baby and you sort of micromanages the details of things and makes sure that everything's going to be okay for you. And then there's the God that lets horrific things happen and that whose responsibility is not to sort of manage every single element of human existence. How do you wrestle with that and still come out on the side of wanting to worship the one that you have landed with?
It's a tenuous battle every single day. And by the way, I want to be clear. I think not believing can be every bit as religious a move as believing. But we'll get to that in a second. I guess here's the thing. Any God big enough to deserve our worship is all of those things. And some days I imagine a God who is this nurturing, gentle, kind of like a big grandmother or grandfather in the sky, even though intellectually I don't believe in that God. I absolutely know that's ridiculous, because if he or she is up there and is that big, loving, all-powerful, gentle grandparent, then she or he is an idiot, because look at how much suffering there is in the world. What I have to acknowledge is that there are days I want that loving grandparent. There are other days I know I can't believe in that loving grandparent, so I want some force for life and meaning and goodness. There are other days I'm not even sure if God exists. And I think actually that's what big belief is. It's allowing yourself to kind of travel the full range. Because if God is God, then that God is infinite. And if that God is infinite, then every conceptualization from absolute denial to absolute certainty about who God is are all part of who that God is.
So you talked about the idea that not believing is as much a sort of a statement of faith as believing. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, there are two ways. First of all, in the extreme, we're talking about kind of a radical secular position. I am certain God does not exist. That sounds like a statement of faith to me, right? In other words, just the way I am certain God does exist. So that's one cluster of atheists. But those atheists actually are both fundamentalists or fanatics. They are 100% certain that their conclusion is correct. And by the way, anyone who is 100% certain that their conclusions are correct 100% of the time, bad things will happen. In the end, that is the definition of a fanatic. It has nothing to do with the individual belief. It has to do with your certainty about your belief. And I'm really waiting for anyone to show me any culture that was 100% certain about 100% of the things it was doing 100% of the time that ended well. But there's another kind of disbelief. It's the kind of disbelief that actually I feel most days when I read the newspaper and you see how much suffering there is. It's that feeling of anger that if you're up there, out there, inside there, what are you doing? Look at the condition of the world. And that kind of sacred rage, whether it masks itself as now I'm denying you, or now I'm going to pray, and my prayer is that you are messing this up, and you need to do better, and you need to give us strength to do better. All of those are sacred responses. You see, a principled atheist, it seems to me, is just a person who looks at the suffering in the world, compares it to the God they learned about when they were 5 and 6 years old, and says, that's nuts. And that kind of disbelief, that disbelief has as much holiness as any believer in any church or any synagogue or any mosque or any temple in the world. Because like the best of believers, that person looks at the human condition and says, this has got to be better.
And that loss of belief because of that is why you think the sort of Bobby God figure is more dangerous in some ways than the one that is a little bit less connected.
Yeah, there's no question about it. The God who gives you all the answers, let's put it this way. If the God you're praying to always tells you what you want and expect to hear, you're not listening to God. You're listening to yourself. And we should be very clear about that. You're listening not to God. You're just listening to your own fantasies that you project onto some other being that doesn't exist anyway, who keeps telling you, you're right, go ahead and do it. You're right, go ahead and do it. Any relationship in which your partner always tells you, you're right, go ahead and do it, that's a lousy relationship. Again, whether it's with your parent or your kid or your lover or your God.
So many people of faith find inspiration and they find reinforcement for their beliefs in their place of worship, what you call, for purposes of this book, the Church of Moskagog?
Moskachurchagog. Yeah.
Many people find it there, but I'm wondering whether you think that faith actually resides within ourselves, or why do so many of us look to an external source to sort of define that relationship?
I think that actually it's always both. It's both internal and external. And the problem is the people who really love the externals, they tend to suppress how internal it is. They get very nervous when someone says, you know, I find faith within. And I'm not so into the institutions. Well, that's not possible. Of course, what they forget is they find faith in those institutions because inside they feel good when they're in those institutions. And the folks who say it's all internal, if they're serious, know it's also external because they can tell you the places in the world that evoke it for them, whether it's a mountaintop or a riverbed or a teepee or anything else. They can tell you what relationships are structured by it, even though it may never have any kind of dogma. They can tell you what kind of practices they have, even though it may have nothing to do with a formal liturgy inside of a book. But they can tell you, yes, on these days of the year, I read this poem. Or we have this practice on our kid's birthday. We always wake them up a certain way. Or, you know, I take putting my kids to bed so seriously because I know that when they pass from being awake to being asleep, that's a really special moment. Well, that special moment, that's what religious folks call sacred. And the real issue would be those people who think they're not religious would go, wow, if I know how to transition my children from wakefulness to sleep and back to wakefulness, I'm a pretty seriously religious individual. I don't care what labels anyone else puts on it.
So, Brad, the title of the book is You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. Okay, so people have different ways of viewing God and their faith. What's the difference between the tension that exists from one faith tradition to the next, as opposed to the difference that exists between people who do believe in God across different sort of lines and people who don't believe at all?
Actually, nothing. There really are no differences. The divide isn't between members of one faith and another faith or the different practitioners within a faith or believers versus non-believers. There's only one divide: the people who think they know it all and the people who are willing to admit they don't. Once you're in the camp of thinking you've solved everything and know it all, you are a fanatic and it's going to be a problem, however well motivated that is. And once you're in the camp of people who say, I have found my faith, but of course I'm filled with questions, and those questions connect me to people who have other answers, pretty much whatever your faith is, it'll be okay. And I guess I feel that so deeply because I went through both sides of that, having once upon a time been in the camp of I have found the answer. I know with absolute certainty. And if you are not with me, you are against me. And I know how bad that can break.
Okay. I really want to talk about that because for a while it was great for you.
Yeah.
And can you talk about how it sort of played itself out and why ultimately? Because as one who never feels like I have all the answers, it seems like for a short time it would be great to have that feeling.
It is great for a short time. I mean, let me back up with a very simple kind of maybe a parallel to what I think that kind of giving yourself over to fanaticism is like. Imagine being really hungry. I'm sure you've been really hungry at different times, right? Just like I've been too busy to eat for like a day and a half and you're going by a Ben and Jerry's or something. And they make that big 40-scoop sundae. And you walk in and go, that sundae? That's for me. I haven't eaten in days and it looks so good. And they're going to put a sparkler in it and they're going to ring the bell when they bring it out to me and I'm going to feel absolutely heroic and I'm going to start to dig in and it is going to taste great. And it does. For 2 scoops, for 3 scoops, if you're me, for 4 scoops. And then you find you're really sick. And that's what it was like for me leaving Chicago and not only going to Israel but going to the West Bank.
And you were a teenager.
Yeah, I was 17. And not only going to the West Bank, but going to Hebron. I needed to find like the most hotly contested piece of real estate anywhere in the world. It makes Jerusalem look like Camp David peace accords. And it is intoxicating because you think you've got all the answers. And when that happens, bad stuff happens, but it does feel good. But I guess because I hear that music, we'll have to talk about that more afterwards.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is my guest. His new book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. He's in town for an address tonight to SMU and the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas. It's an interfaith event, and you can find information about that on our website. If you'd like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start weekly in January. Learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield. His new book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Brad, you were talking about your personal transformation, and you have said that fanatics are attracted to the beauty of what exists.
Yeah, it's very seductive, this fanaticism thing, and I think if we're going to take on fanaticism in the world of any kind, the worst mistake in the world is to assume that fanatics are stupid or deluded or insane. No one really is ever able to engage anyone seriously if they think they're stupid or insane or moronic or anything else, right? It's just the opposite. What most fanatics that I know, and when I was a fanatic, it's about tapping into something really beautiful, but it getting out of control. You know, when I went to Hebron, it was amazing. I had a holy book and a gun. I had celestial power and earthly power wrapped up in a neat little package with a bow on top. And what 17 or 18-year-old doesn't want that? It is incredible to know that you're doing exactly the right thing, exactly the right way, at exactly the right time. You know, I say this a lot, and it's really true. Except for my wedding, I have never danced anywhere like I would dance on Friday night in Hebron. So someone will often ask, well, if it's so beautiful, why'd you get out? Because like that Sunday we were talking about before, that big 40 scooper that makes you sick, at some point they hand you the bill for that kind of certainty. And you realize that not only have you paid a high price, but a lot of other people have probably paid a high price too. And that's what happened for me. At some point into this process, two men who I had enormous respect for, who were themselves rabbis, officers in the Israeli army, had been attacked. And in chasing down their attackers, they ran toward this girls' school and they fired indiscriminately into the school, an act which can only make sense if you were so filled with rage that you lose sight of the idea that you're trying to pursue a criminal and simply are going to vent your rage through the muzzle of your gun. And two girls were killed, were murdered. And I knew at that moment we were paying a price that was far too high. Other people were paying a price that was far too high. Because no matter how beautiful the vision is that brought me there, being there was corrupting it. And when I went to one of the leaders in the Israeli settlement community and said, look, this is crazy. There is something fundamentally wrong with what we're doing. And he said, slow down. It's very sad. Two kids died. They're someone's children. And that is a tragedy. But there's nothing fundamentally wrong with what we're doing. And when he said that, I knew that like any intoxicant, it felt great going in, but was now making us sick because we were pursuing it more and more and more with no sense of what it really cost to pursue.
So are faith and fanaticism part of the same continuum of loving God, or is fanaticism something entirely different that masquerades as a really intense form of faith?
No, I think fanaticism is on a continuum with anything we love or care about, not just faith. And it really is that sense of all or nothing. And that all or nothing, liberals feel all or nothing. Look how they talk about conservatives. Conservatives really feel it about liberals. My God, there would actually be, except for shows like this, no radio if you could make conservatives stop talking that way. Jews feel it about Christians. Christians feel it about Jews. Everyone seems to feel it about Muslims right now and get away with it. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So I think it's not that it's a function of faith. Fanaticism, you know, I guess it's like this. The same thing which allows cells to come together and divide and make life when it gets out of control is called cancer. And I guess what fanaticism is the cancerous version of passion, whether passion for another person or passion for an idea or passion for your God. When it gets out of control and starts eating into other people, it is a cancer. And that's what fanaticism is. It's the cancer of passion.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email from Jim who asks, I would like to know what you think of the concept of ambiguity regarding faith. Carl Sagan, late in his life, when asked about how he squared the circle on his beliefs in science and faith, said that the older he got, the more tolerant of ambiguity he became.
Ambiguity is an absolutely sacred posture. In fact, certainty, I have questions about being really religious, but ambiguity is sacred. Because that's actually, if you want to use religious language as opposed to philosophical, that's what modesty is. That's what humility is. All those beautiful words that religious people like to invoke. We should be more humble. We should be more modest. I say, yes, absolutely. And the place to start is not with someone else's views, but with your own. In fact, it seems to me the higher our tolerance for ambiguity is, without becoming paralyzed by it, the healthier our faith is. In other words, when the ambiguity becomes so overwhelming that we can't decide about anything, then we have a problem in the other direction. And that is the big cultural divide. We've got fanatics on one side and other people who know that fanaticism is crazy, so they're living at loose ends. Healthy faith is one that celebrates the questions as much as the answers, the certainty as much as the ambiguity, and knows that you have to make decisions in life. But when you're making them as decisions that are absolute and unquestionable, probably you've gone too far.
Is there a different structure of tolerance required for people of one faith to say, I believe this, you believe that, and it's fine because you're of a different tradition, as opposed to people that within their own tradition say, well, if you're a Catholic, how could you possibly say this? Or I, too, am a Baptist, and I don't believe that, and you're wrong.
Sure. It's always harder to be open to people who are close to you because we all have this feeling if we're together, then we should agree. And so the people we hurt the most and are hurt by the most are those closest to us. So I always tell people, if you're involved in a, whether it's a religious fight or a political fight or an emotional struggle, remember, you're only struggling so hard because you care that much about the other person. So try and remember as you go through the struggle that it's an expression of your care and struggle accordingly. There's no question. It's easy to be open to people who are practicing an entirely different faith because you figure, it's not mine. It doesn't make any difference. You're not in my backyard, so why care? Just remember, when you're really that annoyed with someone, it's because you really do feel they're in your backyard. Right? We know family squabbles are always the ugliest. But that's because we do have a stake in each other's lives. So then the only issue is knowing that you have a stake in someone else's life, how are you going to conduct the struggle?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield. His new book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. Let's go to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. Hi. I just had, I guess, some thoughts that I feel like relates to what you and the rabbi are talking about. And it's dealing with the Conversations with God series of books by Neil Donald Walsh and 2 points that I guess feels like I feel like can relate to it. And one is that we are the idea that we are all one, and that a statement that ours, just in general, ours is not a better way, and ours is merely another way. And that another idea that's made me think a lot in the last year, and that there is no such thing as right or wrong, and that there is only what works and what does not work, depending on what it is that you seek to be, do, or have. And that's all. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
I guess 3 quick responses. The notion that we're all one, 100% I agree with. That's not going to make every problem go away. It's not going to make every question suddenly answered. It simply means that as we go through life struggles, we actually go through them together. So I think that's really important. The idea that there is no right or wrong, there's only what works. Yes, in principle, that's true, except some people out there are trying to make certain things work that are really dangerous. And so you tell me that, I mean, we just had Martin Luther King Day, right? So if you tell me, yes, but what would work for me would be to attack all African Americans, because I think that would be great for the country. I'm willing to say that's wrong. I think it's really important to say that when someone advocates for harming another person that way, we can say it's wrong. If someone breaks into my home and tries to murder my wife and kids, I do not plan on having a philosophical conversation with them about the fact that it's all one, and if this is working for you, please go ahead and kill me. Now, I want to be fair. There are traditions that would say that's exactly what to do, that that's, in fact, the most evolved thing. But not for me. It seems to me what we have to do is be willing to say, no, there is right and wrong, but the categories are bigger than any of ours. And what it means to decide is more complicated than we will ever know. Right and wrong for me is like a diamond that's been cut with many facets. And the truth is, you can only be on one side of that stone at any given moment. So yes, you have to pick where you want to stand. But be ready to admit that someone standing on the other side may be seeing it very differently. Yes, you have to stake out positions in this life for life to be lived meaningfully. But that's not an excuse for not trying to appreciate the positions that have been staked out by others.
You write that we need to stop pretending there are positions that will satisfy everyone and get used to simply doing our best while admitting the price for the position we have taken. For so many people, though, admitting the price represents a sort of tarnishing of their faith, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess because they're still laboring under this notion that their faith, to be meaningful, has to be perfect. And that's the equivalent of – by the way, that is why people have a hard time sustaining relationships. It is why people end up throwing their kids out of the home and why kids stop talking to their parents because, you know, you hurt me. And this one thing, that blows the whole deal. That's ridiculous. In fact, you'll know how really committed you are to another person or to another idea when you admit it's imperfect, but it's the best one we've got right now, and it's the one that does work for me. And so I'm willing to hang in there with it. And I think that's what You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right is all about. You don't need to assume that what you're doing is perfect and everything else is ridiculous to feel good about it. And we sort of know that. Look, if anyone listening is lucky enough to wake up next to someone they love every morning and they were to say, you know, honey, the reason I'm with you is not because you're beautiful or kind or smart. But everyone else is so much uglier and dumber and meaner that I figure I'll stick around. Right? We know that's ridiculous. So just apply the same test to the ideas in your life. If they're working, if they're making you a little better and the world a little safer, probably that's the right way to go for you. But it may be that someone else will go a different way, and that will also be the right way. It's not about relativism in the sense that everything has to be okay. It just means that what is okay is usually a little bit bigger and more diverse than most of us first imagine.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Gabriel writes, I'm glad that you no longer agree with fanatical faith, but I must agree with Christopher Hitchens. Religion poisons everything it touches. I cannot prove the non-existence of God, but I cannot prove the non-existence of Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Great Pumpkin, or the Tooth Fairy either.
Chris Hitchens is a brilliant fanatic. He is every bit as fanatical about the danger of religion as the fanatically religious are about its saving powers. The truth is, we know that people with religion and people without religion seem to do equally lousy things. We also know that people with religion and people without religion are capable of doing magnificent things. The truth is, we should stop fighting about is it religion or is it not religion? Is it God or not God? Is it a delusion or is it a fact? And simply use a very simple litmus test. If it makes you a little better, helps you to be better to those around you, and commit to something larger than yourself, then it's working. If it doesn't, then it's not. I guess I just don't understand why someone would need to prove that something else, like, you know, that's the answer to all of our problems is to get rid of religion. I don't know. It seems to me we had people who tried to do that in the 20th century, people from, you know, Joseph Stalin to Adolf Hitler to Mao Zedong to Pol Pot. They did a lot of bad stuff without religion. I don't think we're going to get off this hook just by saying it's God's fault or it's not God's fault. In the end, the credit for the condition of the world and the blame for the condition of the world is something we're going to have to shoulder. And hopefully the God we believe in or don't believe in compels us to answer the most important questions in our lives better. But the credit and the blame, that's up to us.
Does God love the people who don't believe?
Any God that I can believe in loves unconditionally and fully and completely. And not only loves, but understands that there is wisdom to be found in disbelief that you'll never have as a believer. And there's also wisdom to be found in being a believer that you'll never have as a disbeliever. And so any God worth believing in would have to know both of those. And maybe that's the difference between thinking about or imagining or wondering or, you know, believing in a God who's infinite and knowing that we're finite. We can only stand in one place at once. But any God worth believing in can stand in every place at once and with every person at once.
So many people who do believe in God embrace the idea that by believing, their lives are somehow enhanced and that it sort of gives them a leg up in the world. Is that advantage of believing in God about the way you experience your own life?
I mean, it's one of the advantages. If it's working for you, then by all means, then you should do it. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I think this idea that somehow if it works, therefore it's not real, right? If it's useful, then it must not be pure. I want to do it the other way around. If it's working and it's making, you know, the human condition better, I would keep trying that. And if it's not, then I would be asking some very serious questions of it. I think part of the problem is when our commitment to the dogma outstrips our willingness to test its impact on other people, that's when I would say, you know, Hitchens may be right. It's time to turn off the God button.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jason in Fort Worth. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good. Well, there's a lot of things I want to talk about, but being the vice president of a free thinkers group here at the university that I attend in Arlington, what gets brought up a lot is what I think is being talked about a lot is the atheist wager, which is a response to Pascal's wager, which Pascal's wager was, if anybody doesn't know who's listening, that it's better to bet in a belief in God knowing that you will be rewarded for that belief. The atheist wager came about later saying that it's better to lead a good life, leaving a good impact on the world and society, knowing that if there is a God in the possibility that there is, that it is an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-omniscient being and will therefore reward you on your merits as opposed to whether or not you believed in it.
Let's get a response. We've got about 40 seconds till we go to the
break. I guess the most important thing is to know that they're both wagers. And I think it's really important to know when you're wagering, that's exactly what it is. It may not break the way you imagine. So if you're a believer, it's important to know that that's a gamble one way. If you're an atheist, it's a gamble the other way. So have a little respect for the person who's gambling the other way, because handicapping, that's a complicated business.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is my guest. He will be speaking tonight at SMU to the SMU Perkins School and also the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas. It's an interfaith event. And you can join us after the break at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start weekly in January. Learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brad Hirschfield. His book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Kevin in Denton. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I guess I have a comment about the word fanaticism that your guest has used a lot. And I think when you use the word fanaticism in this conversation, it belongs to the religious person. It uses it as if there's two sides, and the secularists have these fanatics that are acting equally as insane. And I just don't agree with that because, you know, I'm an atheist, and I subsequently hang around with a lot of atheists, and we aren't flying flames into buildings. You know, we aren't committing these acts of terror in the name of being a secularist, nor is anyone that I know of. So I'd just like him to comment about that, if he could.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Look, the first thing I hope all atheists go out and do is start talking with people who are believers. And I tell believers all the time, if you don't have a friend who you respect who's a non-believer, your belief isn't very real. Here's what we know. There are horrible things committed in the name of God and horrible things committed by atheists. No, it's true. It was people acting in the name of God who flew planes into buildings. But it's also true that the current scourge of suicide bombing was initiated by the Tamil Tigers, that are an absolutely secular group, and that most people think this is something that was created by Islamists, and it's not true. It was created by national separatists who had no religious stake in the game whatsoever. So in fact, what we know is any time your belief gets you to a point where you're 100% certain, there's a problem. And the most important thing is that people like me, who consider myself a believer, actively admit religion does some terrible things. And then people who are non-believers would actually identify what are the shortfalls of disbelief. Because the best critique to level is the critique at your own beliefs, not someone else's.
You said a minute ago that you say to your believer friends that if they don't have one person they respect and that they have befriended, that who does not believe, their faith isn't very strong. Why do so many religious traditions encourage people to avoid contact or too much dialogue except to proselytize with people who don't believe?
Fear. I mean, that's what it really comes down to. I don't believe the best of any faith, by the way, does that. I think the moment you're talking about a group that in the name of faith discourages real engagement with other people, that's for me one of the litmus tests when religion slips into being a cult. Being a cult has nothing to do with wearing funny clothes or having a book that was created 50 years ago as opposed to 2,000 years ago, because even the 2,000-year-old books were once 50 years old. So we should be very clear. The line between a faith and a cult is not how old it is or how accepted it is or anything else. It does have to do, though, with things like, do you encourage people in your community to be engaged with and learn from people in other communities? Do you punish people when they question? Do you tell people that if you leave, you will be miserable and use fear as a tactic? And the truth is, everyone from folks with new religions to old religions does that. And I think it really does come down to fear. It really comes down to a lack of self-confidence. It comes down, that's the sad irony, to having no faith in what you profess to be your faith.
Is there a point at which that engagement with people of other belief systems really the benefits of it end? I know as a rabbi, you don't perform interfaith marriages, for example.
It's true, I don't. But as I talk about in the book, it's one of the things that if there is a God in heaven before who I'm called to account, I think I might get a kick in the pants. No, I don't think that there's any point at which contact with others loses its benefit. I think that everyone needs to struggle with how best to do it, to feel they're maintaining their integrity, but also stretching their boundaries. In a lot of ways, for me, some of the stuff that I wrote about in the book was a way of stretching my own boundaries and coming to grips with stuff. I would say further that anyone who is not committed to certain practices, that they're actively questioning and wondering if they're doing it right, then they're doing it wrong. And the truth is that although as a traditional Jew, as an Orthodox rabbi, whatever you want to call it, I do not perform marriages between Jews and non-Jews. I wrestle with that every day. And frankly, if I didn't have colleagues I respected to whom I could send such couples, I might reconsider the position. And the most important thing is, which I also talk about in the book, is that if a genie came down and offered me a deal in which my three daughters would find happy, meaningful lives with a loving partner that would be with them throughout the whole journey who happened not to be Jewish, I would sign in a heartbeat. Because in the end, this stuff is supposed to make us more whole as people and make the world a better place. And while it would unnerve me in some ways, it would be dishonest to tell you that as a parent, that's not what I hope for my kids.
So until that time comes, you're okay with sort of punting?
It's not punting. I'm okay with encouraging people to keep questioning what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm comfortable with saying that everyone better have things like that. If punting means I accept my limitations and give it over to the other side, then yes, but then punting becomes something positive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what all of us would have to understand. At some point in the game, you've run your downs and you actually can't hold the ball anymore. And that's okay. You give it to the other side, and ironically, that's what keeps the game going. So for me, what I experience when people do stuff that I personally can't do is that's great, because together, that's how we keep the game going. If everyone did it my way and I never punted, then actually we would have no game.
We have just pushed the limits of my ability to stay with a sports metaphor. So we should move on to the next call at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Jason in Plano. Hi, Jason.
Hi. This has been very interesting, and I was just curious. Some of what's been expressed both in the kind of the view of God and in the rabbi's own personal faith journey reminds me a lot of some of the writings of someone from my own faith tradition, Bishop John Spong. I was wondering if he saw similarities between their lives and stories, or what other men and women of other faith traditions he finds real similarities and common ground in this belief with.
I appreciate the comment, and I don't know if I deserve the comparison, because John Spong is a heroic figure. And he's heroic precisely because he has been willing to hang in with a faith as he aggressively questions it and understands that to love something is to both support it and to question it in equal measure. I think that every tradition has people like this, and I think that if you don't know at least one what I would call kind of, you know, sacred rebel in your own tradition, then you don't know the depth of your own tradition. And it's really important to find those sacred rebels. You know, Jewish history is filled with them. I guess the first one was the first Jew, was Abraham, who actually couldn't mature into being a Jew until he was one day willing to look at God and say, if you behave badly at Sodom and Gomorrah and you actually kill innocent people along with guilty people, you're done being God. And so one of the great insights of the Hebrew Bible is that the world's first monotheist, at least as it conceives of it, is also the first atheist. And that's the balance. The more profoundly you are committed to anything, the more ready you have to be to walk away from it. And the more you think you're ready to walk away, the more you're obligated to go back and give it a second chance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gary in Dallas. Hi, Gary.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, I had a question. Do you believe there is something fundamentally wrong with Islam, since they've basically approached every single conflict in the past through violence, like Constantinople, you know, Crusade, Iran-Iraq war, Israel-Palestine, Iraq war right now, suicide bombing, train bombings, everything has been always accomplished only through violence. What do you think about that?
I mean, the quick answer is no. No, there is not anything fundamentally wrong with Islam. There may be something fundamentally wrong for some people with all religious faith, and in that, Islam is no less to blame than Judaism or Christianity. The truth is
they certainly don't have a market on violence, sadly.
Right. I mean, that's the point. I understand that right now, the majority of people who blow things up in the name of God know that God is Allah. But if we look at human history, the sad truth is that there isn't a faith on earth that hasn't been bloodied in the name of other people's God and hasn't bloodied other people in the name of their own. And it's really important that we understand that. It is not about any one faith. It is about how people who are part of that faith choose to make it come alive. Right? There was a long run of Christian violence. If you go back earlier, there was a long run of Jewish violence. You know, we forget that because it's been a long time since Jews had that kind of power to do that kind of violence. But, you know, so it's not about Islam. It's not that I don't think the Muslim world has things to wrestle with. It does. If there are 1.3 billion Muslims and 300 million of them support violence married to religion, we have a problem. But it's not a problem with Islam any more than I would say it's a problem with any tradition when its proponents do bad things. What it is a call to all those people who don't support that vision to rise up and say, not in our name. We're the same tradition that gave geometry to the world. We're the same tradition that preserved the works of Socrates and Aristotle when the church was burning it. We're the same tradition that was actually far better to Jews than Christians ever were when we controlled them. Is Islam perfect? No. Is Christianity perfect? No. Is Judaism perfect? No. Is atheism perfect? No. Each of them has proud accomplishments. Each of them has dark moments. And the trick is to acknowledge both, always.
You make a point in the book that truth can be total and yet at the same time incomplete. Can you talk about that for a minute as it relates to the idea for certain people that, for example, the only salvation is through Jesus, or the only path to righteousness is through Judaism? Can you speak about that?
Yeah, I just want them to add two words to the end of that claim, for me or for us. At that moment, I do understand when a person has been saved by their faith in Jesus Christ, or a person says, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, or someone says the Hebrew Bible and the subsequent rabbinic tradition are perfect as they are. They are for each of those believers. In other words, that truth fills you up, so it is total. But it may not fill me up, so it's not complete. It is absolutely right for you, but not absolute for everybody. And I guess that's the point, is that we, because we're all finite, can be filled up with any one of those truths. But since truth, if it comes from God and God is infinite, is going to have many, many expressions. And I think that's the thing to try and remember, is that it can be completely compelling for you, whatever it is you believe, without you needing to insist it be completely compelling for the rest of us.
Brad, you communicate very candidly here in this book and in your other work about the questions that you have and the struggles that you've had. But I wonder if you'd speak for a minute about the challenges that a person who is openly religious, who has chosen to be a religious leader and a teacher, the challenges that you face in terms of having to sort of be on your best behavior, or people assume that you have all the answers to the horrifying questions of why are we here? Why would God let this happen? How do you cope with that and still sort of hold your head up high and think that you have any answers?
I guess I could tell you I behave badly and shatter all the misconceptions quickly in the relationship. So if you lower expectations enough, no one's ever disappointed. But that wouldn't be exactly true. I try and be really candid about my own questions and my own struggles in the hopes that if people can see it's possible to really commit and really give yourself over to something without pushing down the questions, that that's really the lesson. I don't have a magic wand. God knows there are days I wish I did. What I think I have is access to a set of traditions that really animate me. And they help me make the world more reasonable, and I hope motivate me to make a small contribution to it. And that's what I would encourage everybody to try and find. And if you're looking for something that's going to make all the questions go away, the only thing I can tell people is show me any time that ever works, and I'll reevaluate. I simply don't know of any system that promised to answer all the questions finally and totally for all people for all time that didn't end up abusing lots of people. And I know of no system that didn't invite people to come and explore and experiment and adapt and live out the wisdom of that tradition that couldn't help large numbers of people. And for some people, that happens under the sign of a crescent, and for some people under the sign of the infinity symbol, and for some people under the cross, and some people under a star, and some people under a totem pole. And that's great, because again, if what we're pursuing is the infinite and we're all finite, we're going to need every single possible human experiment out there. And maybe taken all together, they'll approximate that infinite goal.
How do you measure your own progress?
Wow, that's a great question. I guess the first rule is that if I always think I'm moving in the right direction, I'm not. That's the first thing to know. I try and take as much stock of where I'm falling short and let that be okay. Not to be ashamed of it, but actually to know the more I know I'm not quite there, actually the more alive I am and the greater this journey is going to be.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is a radio and TV host and president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. His new book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. And you can see him speak tonight at 7:30 at SMU. There's information about that on our website. Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.